Despite the fact that I don't listen to the radio and I don't read music magazines, there's very little important music that I've discovered on my own. Eric brought the first Art of Noise EP, Into Battle, home from the record store in which he worked and ignited that passion. My long-lost friend Bent turned me on to the whole Fats Comet Tackhead collective. Friends know that I'm passionate about music, and I always do what I can to turn them onto new stuff, and they usually reciprocate. Buying music completely blindly is a very risky proposition. Covers can be misleading, and what looks good on paper often sounds terrible on plastic. But there are a couple of notable exceptions. Sometimes you can trust somewhat a label you've come to know, and in the late 80s, I'd often carefully study any On You or Network or Zhang Tum Tum discs I ran across. But occasionally, a completely blind purchase will turn out to be surprisingly wonderful. I bought Thomas Dolby's phenomenal Golden Age of the Wireless album without knowing anything about it, and it has become one of my all-time favorites. That is, the long-deleted original version, before they shoehorned his surprise hit She Blinded Me With Science onto it and muscled out the sublime Leipzig and Urges. And I bought Negative Land's Escape from Noise album solely on the strength of the cover and some of the instruments that were supposed to be played on it. Including bomb parts, half-speed violin, processed animals, and Booper Bee. And discovered my favorite collective of media terrorists. But by far the most serendipitous blind purchase I made was in Chicago, at famed Roses Records, when I took a chance on an unknown quantity called Yellow. The album was their first, Solid Pleasure, and I can't tell you exactly why I picked it up. It was on Ralph Records, the resident's notoriously weird San Francisco-based label. The residents were mostly good in theory, but too outrageously weird to listen to for long. Although I enjoyed the discipline and variety of their commercial album, in which each of the 40 songs is exactly 1 minute long. And a classmate of mine in high school choreographed a truly weird dance piece to an even weirder song from his Snakefinger album on Ralph that, while not wholly unappealing, was still impressively bizarre. And included his song, You Sliced Up My Wife, which I appreciated because it was shortly after Debbie Boone's horrific You Light Up My Life had finally released its incomprehensible hold on the top of the charts. You sliced up my wife, you sliced up my wife, you sliced her up. You sliced up my wife, you sliced up my wife, you sliced her up. She wouldn't let me go to the ball game. You know just how much I like a ball game. She thought you were toast and I was tame. But she was wrong. Rose Records was perversely arranged not by artist or genre, but by label release number, making it rather difficult to find anything, and I stumbled onto the Ralph Records section one day early in my year at the University of Chicago, and looked through it, trying to get the courage up to buy something new. The Residents and Snakefinger were known and not entirely appreciated weirdnesses, so I peered at a few other releases and tried to divine the contents of them from their jackets. One of them, Solid Pleasure by Yellow, with no W, caught my eye. Partially because the only instruments listed on the back were vocals and electronics and tapes and effects. 3 out of 4 ain't bad. And partly because there was a sticker on it quoting some record review that said if all things were equal, Solid Pleasure would be as popular as Pink Floyd's legendary Dark Side of the Moon, which I love. I mentioned this later to my stepfather Frank, and he pointed out that if everything were equal, then everything would be as popular as Dark Side of the Moon. An undeniable bit of logic. Still, it looked like a likely candidate, so I took a deep breath and plunked down my money and took it back to my dorm room to listen to. Hated it.
You think you're special and you're a standard guy. I'm gonna tell you, you're nothing but a standard guy. You are a standard. Standard.
Well, I didn't hate it, but it certainly wasn't love at first listen. It opened with the promising Bimbo, but then quickly slid downhill. There were some interesting sounds on it, and some intriguing music, but most of the tracks were indelibly marred by colossally irritating vocals.
All right, folks! This was today's showtime, and now go home! See you tomorrow! Same time, same place! Take care!
There was one highly propulsive dance track at the end of side one called Bostitch, in which the vocals, though they didn't make a lick of sense, fit the sound of the song and added to the momentum.
Standing at the machine every day for all my life, I must do it and I need it. It's the only thing I want is just to rush, push, cash.
And there was a pleasant and evocative instrumental called Blue Green that I took to immediately. And there were little moments throughout that were wonderful, but most of the album left me pretty cold, and I found it away after a few listenings. I did, however, take moderate pleasure in putting Blue Green on tapes for my friends, partly because it was an engaging track, and partly because I liked the way the title would look when I wrote it on the tape cover. Blue Green, Yellow. Ha ha ha. I bought Solid Pleasure early in my year at the University of Chicago, before I really knew what I was in for. After everything had blown up and I moved into a single room and quit all my required classes and threw my academic career in the toilet, I bought Claro KC, Yellow's second album. The death grip Chicago had on me was starting to loosen up. Winter was finally breaking up, and the wind, for which the city is so justifiably known, was starting to be less like a knife and more like a caress. I was taking an electronic music workshop and an introductory art class and a filmmaking class, and was much happier for it. Being out of the poisonous force relationship with my roommate helped immeasurably, and I actually had a couple of friends I really liked and who seemed to understand and appreciate who I was and what was important to me. And I had discovered the near north side of Chicago, a much cooler and funkier neighborhood than downtown or the south side where the UFC was. One of the landmarks for me up there was the Wax Trax record store, also home of the industrial label that bore their name. They had all kinds of wonderfully weird music in stock, and I no longer felt like a complete Martian when I went in there. They were always playing something interesting, whether it was the new Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark album or the latest single from New Order, and I felt gleefully at home whenever I made the trek up there. I don't know what prompted me to buy Claro KC. I wasn't particularly crazy about Solid Pleasure, but thought it showed promise. At the very least, I thought I might be able to get a good instrumental out of it, something along the lines of Blue Green. Claro KC was pretty much what I expected it to be. More of the same. Lots of interesting music and exciting electronics paved over with some really grating vocals. But, as predicted, there was a great instrumental on it, the evocative, slightly tropical, somewhat cinematic Homer Hasa. I really can't say why I stuck with them and gave them as many chances as I did, but my perseverance was about to be paid off in spades. They say your first apartment is your worst apartment, and Eric and I made sure that that was going to be the case by getting a laughably bad apartment together the summer after he graduated from Interlaken. Actually, he didn't do quite as well as I did in that department, and had a couple of stunningly awful pads after I went back to school the following year. He was a year younger than me and ready to move to New York City and find his fortune in the professional dance world. I was more than ready to walk away from college and start doing something practical and easily understandable. The equation, need to eat equals get a job, made a lot more sense to me than get a degree equals read Descartes did. I desperately missed living with him, and after a difficult year with a roommate he ended up hating, he was just as eager to get back together with me. So we packed up our bags, bid our cheerful and fearful mothers goodbye, and boarded a plane for New York City. We moved to the city in the middle of the summer, and an old classmate of ours agreed to let us crash on his floor for a couple of weeks while we got settled. His name was Bruce, and while I didn't know him very well, he and Eric apparently hit it off during my absence in Chicago. I was grateful to have a place to start, and when the cab let us off in front of his West Village apartment, our New York adventure officially began. Bruce was an interesting character. He had been in an awful accident when he was a child. Climbing a tree, he grabbed onto an electric wire that wasn't supposed to be there and was almost killed. As it was, he endured many painful operations and his right hand was permanently fused together, which made him very self-conscious about it. I always surmised that that was the reason he had taken up the French horn, so he could hide his disfigured hand in the great brass bell of the instrument, and he was always very quick to be the first to offer his left hand for a handshake to avoid the awkwardness of exposing his right hand. Under the boardwalk, under the sun, under the boardwalk, we'll be having some fun. Under the boardwalk, people walking apart. Under the boardwalk, we'll be making love. Under the boardwalk, boardwalk. Because of the horrific accident, his family had sued the power company, which had apparently run the power lines through the trees illegally, and they ended up with a large and justified settlement. The money was held in a trust until Bruce was older, but he got a very generous monthly allowance from it and was setting himself up in style in the village. He was also gay and was really enjoying the opportunity to explore that lifestyle in such a positive environment. Not that Interlaken wasn't tolerant, but the West Village in the early 1980s, before the specter of AIDS had really ripped its way through the community, must have been quite an exhilarating experience. He took us in, showed us our spot on the floor, got us stoned, and walked us around the village for a couple of hours. It was overwhelming. Eventually, I would acquire my New York City blinders, but coming from the quiet woods of Michigan, the city blew my head wide open. Even my time in Chicago failed to prepare me for the intense urbanicity of New York City. Sights and sounds and smells, it was summer after all, came pouring in so quick and fast that I was nearly paralyzed, and I had to keep looking down at my feet every now and then to make sure they were still moving, and then immediately look up again so I didn't lose Eric and Bruce in the crowds. When we got back to the apartment, I was exhausted and overwhelmed and went to sleep. Eric and I dove in the next morning, leaping into the formidable task of establishing ourselves in the city. Bruce was very generous in letting us crash at his pad, but it was a small loft, and it was clear that we had to get out of it as soon as possible. So we went to work trying to find an apartment before we really focused on getting jobs. But there was a catch-22 in effect. Employers like you to have an address before they give you a job, and landlords like you to have a job before they give you an address. So we were caught in a vicious circle. I knew we were both responsible people, but nobody else in the city did. And New Yorkers, as I was learning, are a suspicious breed and tend to assume the worst about you and your intentions. So it was quite a difficult hurdle. Finally, we found a guy who ran a big building on 23rd Street in Chelsea, just a few doors down from the infamous Chelsea Hotel, who agreed to rent us an apartment. He even offered to throw in some furniture that had been lying around in the basement, and we eagerly took him up on his offer of a convertible couch, thereby saving us an expense neither of us could afford. We were on our way. The apartment was amazing. We were in no position to turn it down, but it was truly awful. It was on the 14th floor of a 22-floor building, and it was an internal apartment, which meant that the one window of the room looked out over the air shaft in the middle of the building. You had to open up the window, stick your head out, and twist it around and look straight up to see what kind of day it was. Oh, it's sunny! There was a disgusting, heavily stained green carpet on the floor, which we immediately ripped up and threw away, revealing the badly scratched up hardwood floor underneath. Unfortunately, ripping up the carpet also revealed the rows of nailed boards that ran around the circumference of the room, with hundreds of carpet tacks sticking straight up that had held the carpet in place. The boards were rotting and impossible to remove, so you always had to be careful not to sit or step too close to the walls, or you'd impale yourself on a bunch of rusty nails. This row of death also stretched across the thresholds, so you'd have to take special care in walking from room to room. Fortunately, there weren't too many rooms, so this wasn't much of a problem. In fact, there was really only one 12 by 12 room, with a small bathroom and an even smaller kitchen, in which you could stand in the center and touch all four walls at the same time. I cooked one and only one meal in that room, and was so hot and sweaty when it was over that I practically threw the food at Eric and said, "Here's your dinner!" The only thing we ever really did in the kitchen was defrost the freezer, which had to be done every couple of weeks or the refrigerator door wouldn't close. Defrosting the freezer was an hours-long ordeal that involved hair dryers and pots of boiling water. You'd finally finish it and plug it back in, and in a matter of hours, the ice was already starting to cake up around the sides. Being that it was summer in New York City in an apartment with one window that overlooked an air shaft, it was fucking hot all the time. As we were quickly discovering, New York City summers are not just hot, They are humid and relentlessly so. There isn't even any relief after the sun goes down, and each night became a hellish endurance test, and we'd wake up cranky and exhausted from tossing and turning and sweating all night. The only relief from the sweat was for about 5 minutes after you took a shower. The shower was freakishly strong and was either off completely or on paint removal strength with nothing in between. And you'd have to cower against the far wall, having the top layers of skin blasted off while the shower curtain whipped around you in a frenzy. A quick rub with a perpetually damp and smelly towel and you were ready to face the day.
Dip, 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 dip.
Now that we had a place to hang our hats, or bang our bats, it was time to get jobs. Again, being green in New York City with no history and no references, and no real skills, didn't endear us to many prospective employers, who figured we'd just bolt when things got hard. Like, what? They were going to get harder? But Eric got a job almost immediately. And what's more, he got a job that he didn't have to go to. He was hired by a small food stand in the newly completed South Street Seaport called Pasta and Cheese 123, which prepared a couple of quick pasta choices with some sauces for easy consumption by the business and tourist types that haunted the financial areas on the south end of Manhattan. Although he had been hired, they weren't quite ready for business yet, construction delays and the like, so he had the security of a job without actually having to do anything for a couple of weeks. Me, I was not so lucky. I applied at a bewildering assortment of places for an increasingly bizarre selection of jobs and was always rejected. I applied to be a butler in a clothes store in Soho. The store was available for shopping by appointment only, and my job would be to wear a tuxedo and try to keep a straight face when the customers asked if that pair of socks was really $300, and I'd have to explain that no, it was really $300 per sock. Not having a downtown art boy fashion model look, I didn't get that job. Just as well, wearing a tuxedo in the hell that was New York in the summer would have been just too much.
If you invest your tuppence wisely in the bank, safe and sound.
I applied for a job as a messenger for a stocks and bonds newsletter company in the financial district. The guy that interviewed me pointed out that I was new to the city and couldn't possibly know all the streets, especially in the confusing downtown section where they did most of their business, which was settled and named before they realized a grid pattern of numbered streets and avenues would be a much better idea. I pointed out that they had recently invented something called a map that would help me, and besides, I was young and strong and eager, and I'm sure I could do a good job and blah blah blah. Then he launched into a tirade about his son, also an only child about my age, had gone off on his own to the city because he felt sheltered and thought he wanted to challenge himself and try to make it on his own because he thought he was spoiled. But what he really did was break his poor mother's heart, and couldn't I see what a selfish jerk I was for not staying at home, and so on for 15 minutes. Whatever. I applied for a job as a diamond sorter. Didn't get it. I applied for a job that was mysteriously vague in the ad, always a bad sign, and when I got to the appointed place and time, discovered a room full of people also wondering just what they were doing there. A well-dressed young woman came in and gave a motivational speech about how she used to be poor and black and homeless, and thanks to this wonderful business opportunity, she'd become rich and pretty and white, and how we could all do the same thing if we just had the right attitude. What the mind could conceive, the body could achieve, and so on. Meanwhile, she handed a small cushion to the person closest to her, asked that they sit on it for a moment, and then pass it to the next person. While she continued on with her motivational speech, I watched as the cushion made its way around, or rather under, each person in the room. As each person sat on it, their faces would register surprise and alarm, and they'd quickly pass it to the next person, who accepted it gingerly. It finally made its way around to me, and hesitantly, I placed it under my Butox and sat down. Immediately, the pillow started vibrating violently. It was not an altogether unpleasant experience. In fact, under the right circumstances, it could actually be quite pleasurable. But a group job interview was definitely not the right circumstance, and I quickly passed it to the next person, who took it as though I was handing her a turd. Turned out we were being groomed to be door-to-door vibrating pillow salesmen, and according to our spokesmodel, the streets of Midtown were lined with gold. All we had to do was walk into an office, demonstrate our superior product to some of the secretaries, and soon retire to our penthouse overlooking Central Park. Right. I also applied for a job as a photo finisher in a custom photo lab. This was actually a job I had some experience in, having not only studied photography in high school, but also having worked for a summer printing photos for the National Music Camp. The interview went very well. We got along great. They were impressed with my experience and my personality, and I rode the number 2 train back downtown, convinced that I had finally gotten the job. I hadn't. Things were getting desperate. I was out of money. A check my mom had sent me never came because she thought I lived at 208 East 23rd Street instead of 208 West 23rd Street, a one-letter mistake that took nearly a month to sort out. She and Frank were finally getting married, and I was coming back home for the wedding, and there was the implication being made that if I didn't have a job by that time, I wouldn't be allowed to come back after the wedding. Now, I was an adult and didn't need my mother's permission for anything, but I did need a little financial help during these uncertain times, and without that, and her help with an airline ticket, my chances of returning to New York were virtually nil. So, discouraged, I picked up the next week's Village Voice and pored over the ads, circling and calling like mad. I had several interviews, the weirdest one by far being at something called a stat shop. I had no idea what a stat shop was, but I called them anyway, and they told me to come on in. They needed counter people, and no particular experience was necessary. The interview was terrible. The man who questioned me asked if I knew what a photostat was, and I briefly tried to fake it, but I knew I couldn't really, so I admitted that I didn't. He asked me a couple of quick math questions, which I did all right on, and then the owner came in to ask me some questions. Well, one question. What color would you paint your bathroom? I stared at him, not sure I had heard the question correctly. Come on, come on, I'm a busy man, he barked. Black and yellow with a little purple neon trim around the mirror, I sputtered. I have no idea why I said that. It certainly isn't a bathroom treatment I would favor, but there it was. He snorted derisively and walked out of the room. The assistant manager thanked me for coming in, and I mechanically thanked him back and shook his hand, but I knew I had blown the interview and walked dejectedly back to my apartment, which was only about 6 blocks away. I took a deep breath and made some more calls and went on a few more interviews, none of them particularly promising, and I tried to come to grips with the fact that I wasn't going to be able to live in New York with Eric anymore and would have to spend the rest of my days holed up in my mom's house in Michigan, staring forlornly out the window at the endless fields of snow, my life a complete failure. That weekend, the phone rang, and I picked it up. Hello, is Chris there? Speaking. Hi, Chris. It's Stuart. I just wanted to let you know you got the job. Be here Monday at 9 o'clock. Thanks. Click. I've had my show. I got the job. I leapt up and I grabbed onto Eric and we danced around the apartment. I got a job. I don't have to leave. I can stay here and everything is going to be all right. He was nearly as psyched as I was and asked what job I got. I stopped. Oh my God. I have no idea. I went on half a dozen interviews and met twice as many people, and all their names immediately slipped off the back of my head as soon as I heard them. Stuart? Who the hell was Stuart? I tried to think, but I couldn't come up with it. Oh, shit. I can't believe it. I finally get a job, but I don't know what job it is, and if I don't show up at the right place on Monday morning, then I'm sure to be fired. I can't call the numbers from the ads back because it's the weekend. So I'll just have to pick a place and get there early enough so that if they don't know who I am or what I am doing there, then I can still get to one of the other ones, only a little late. That cuts my chances down from 1 in 6 to 1 in 3. But those are still pretty bad odds. Shit. Monday morning came, and I decided to go to the place I liked the most and hope for the best. Despite the terrible interview, the place I liked the best was the stat shop, just a few blocks away. It seemed to have the most interesting people working there, so I had a quick breakfast and made my way down 22nd Street, past the Flatiron Building, my favorite in New York, and to the stat shop. My heart in my throat, I took a deep breath and walked into the store and stood nervously at the counter, the clock reading 8:45. A big man with a beard and a gruff demeanor looked up at me accusingly. I swallowed. "You must be Chris," he said. I grinned, assuring him I was. "You're early." "I like that." "Welcome to the SMP Graphic Service Center. I'm Kip, the manager. Come on around the corner, we'll get you started." That afternoon, when I got back to my apartment, I found my mom's check had made its way through its tortuous journey. The envelope decorated with an impressive array of stamps and handwritten directions. I cashed it and, giddy with excitement, went out for dinner and a little shopping with Eric. Ever since we had first arrived in the city, I had been seeing ads announcing the grand opening of a giant flagship Tower Records in the village. Although the temptation to go there was great, I vowed not to step foot into the store until I had a job, knowing I would be unable to resist buying something, and also knowing that I was on as bare a budget as could be, with everything short of food and rent and subway tokens, and an occasional dime bag from the pot store uptown, being an extravagant luxury. Cash in hand, and name on a W4, I eagerly coaxed Eric into that wondrous hall of music, impossibly large, incredibly well-stocked, overwhelmingly cool. I stood in the doorway and looked around, trying to decide where to start, practically fainting with excitement. I had done it. I was a fucking New Yorker. I was home. Having arrived in New York with no address and no assurance I would be able to stay, I only brought along the bare necessities. That meant clothes and toiletries and a few tapes, but no stereo. Eric had a tape deck, and we lived on that for the first few weeks. Although I hated buying pre-recorded tapes for their notoriously bad sound quality and linear playing mode, no easily skipping to a later track, I really wanted to get something new that I could hear right away. So I reluctantly bypassed the gigantic record floors and went into the basement where the tapes were kept. I poked around a little bit and came across the latest release from Yellow, called You Gotta Say Yes to Another Excess. Having been intrigued by bits of their first two albums, I decided to give them one more chance, and I bought the tape and stuck it in my pocket, and we walked back uptown to our apartment through the, finally, cooling evening air.
Somehow, lost. Don't think like a madman.
Legend has it that Boris Blank was walking through an abandoned industrial site with a tape recorder, banging things and recording their sounds. He turned a corner and surprised Carlos Peron, who was doing precisely the same thing. From that chance meeting, Yellow was born. Yellow is the only Swiss group I know of, and if they are any indication of what goes on in that country, then the Borgias can keep their renaissance. Give me chocolate and cuckoo clocks any day. Blank and Peron supplied the wildly inventive palette of noises that made up the distinctive sound of Yellow. Not content to follow in anybody else's footsteps, they used electronics and tapes and effects in wholly original ways. Their music sounds unlike anything else anybody else was doing at the time. Other groups were interested in electronic music, but they usually slavishly followed the cold, robotic precision of pioneers Kraftwerk or the lush sound of the New Romantics with their deep debt to disco. This is, of course, not to disparage either, as I love them both, but Yellow's music wasn't beholden to either of those camps. Much of what they did had a strong beat and was popular on the dance floor, but they tended towards more Latin rhythms, with tracks like Downtown Samba, Pinball Cha-Cha, and Bananas to the Beat. These tracks were full of unusual sounds, and they'd pull their rhythmic accents from the most unlikely sources. It's not uncommon to be settling into one of their grooves and suddenly hear pig grunts, or footsteps, or clocks ticking, or chickens squawking in perfect rhythm. But as creative as they were with their beats, they were not tied to the dance floor, and their early albums are full of intriguing industrial soundscapes or haunting cinematic mood poems. The tracks blend and flow into each other, creating mysterious soundtracks to unseen movies. Blank and Peron were masters of sound, and made music that existed in some alternate reality. And then there's Dieter Meier.
100,000 people walking down the street trying to protect their dream, following their feet. Their busy eyes can't find the one they're looking for in the skies.
I have a theory that once somebody's music starts getting too cool, the aural equivalent of the Men in Black come visiting and make them put some smelly vocalizing on it to take the edge off. Severed Head starts getting too interesting? Make Tom Ellard sing. That'll keep them in line. Tackhead pushing the envelope of hardcore industrial dance funk a little too hard? Give them Gary Clayle to megaphone his irritating slogans over the crushing beats. Art of Noise getting too good? Stick them with Max Headroom.
Giving a rest between bars. On drums, Martin, drums, mums, the Pope.
And since nobody made more exciting, interesting, and innovative music than Yellow, then nobody got a worse vocalist. It boggles my mind that somebody so creative and so far ahead of the musical curve as Boris Blank would allow his meticulously assembled, gorgeously evocative jewels to be shat upon by somebody so irritating and artless as Dieter Meyer. Theory about this, too. Making music like this, especially at this point in time, took an enormous amount of energy and, especially, equipment. And Yellow wasn't exactly making double platinum albums. The money had to come from somewhere. And Dieter Meyer is a millionaire industrialist, a professional gambler, and a member of Switzerland's national golf team. So my theory is that Dieter foots the bills in exchange for getting to put whatever bizarre and inappropriate vocals he wanted to all over Boris and Carlos's beautiful tracks. This is especially true on the first two Yellow albums, where every time the music starts to get really good, here comes old Dieter with some really bad poetry yelled at top volume, or some teeth-grindingly awful performance art ramblings or bad pseudo-art dramatics. Occasionally, the vocals kind of fit the tracks and can be ignored. But more often than not, they just crash into the room, knocking over the delicate track and trampling it into unlistenable sludge. Yeah. one has to work really hard to hear around Dieter's verbal diarrhea, but the little snatches that shone through were so intriguing that I kept sticking with it. Finally, with You Gotta Say Yes to Another Excess, my patience was rewarded. You Gotta Say Yes to Another Excess is a giant leap forward in Yellow's work. The production, which had always been a bit muddy, starts to take on a more distinct, more sophisticated sheen.
I told you, lady, take me for one day. Please don't ask any questions. You know I can't stay.
The songs still employ a breathtakingly original sonic palette, but they're organized into more coherent chunks. Rhythms predominate, but they are created from entirely different sources and sounds than anybody else would or could do. There's something slightly familiar about a lot of the sounds, but they've been twisted and processed so completely that they take on a mystifying character. And finally, even Dieter has started to settle down and made his bizarre rantings fit the music a little better instead of just getting in the way, like he was actually listening to what else was going on around him.
I know this is crazy. Let's have a last drink. Don't ask where I come from. And don't ask what I think. I leave you, lady, full of desire to stay.
His lyrics were still largely nonsense, but at least it was somewhat appropriate nonsense. He can even achieve something close to touching, as on the curiously wistful Lost Again. Continuing their exploration of alternative types of dance music, You Gotta Say Yes to Another Excess, You Gotta Say No to Such a Long Album Title, includes the wonderful Swing. A twisted take on big band music that perfectly captures their unique combination of familiar and bizarre. There's a track that sounds like a distant cousin to the stripped-down airless funk sound of Talking Heads Speaking in Tongues, which was in vogue at the time. And the album closes with a bizarre, sweaty, all-or-nothing instrumental dance track that starts slow and creepy and ends up in an ecstatic, orgasmic explosion and features what sounds like glaciers ripping apart and strumming mandolins. A bracingly weird, excitingly original, wholly infectious, completely satisfying album. Fortunately, Eric was as smitten as I was because I could not get enough of it and wanted to hear it constantly. Which is why when I saw that Yellow was coming to play a concert in New York, I jumped at the chance. Eric was as stoked as I was, and we made plans for the big night. Since New York is the place to be if you want to be a professional dancer, several of our Interlochen Arts Academy classmates had also made the trek to the Holy City. Somehow, we got some of them involved in the plans, and ended up at the apartment of one of them to gather before the concert. Being dancers, they were all thin and beautiful, but being dancers, they were also crazy, and any attraction Eric or I felt for them had long since faded into guarded camaraderie. Still, there was something sort of cool about going out for a night in the town with two beautiful women on each arm, and I, for one, felt pretty manly. It was a cold night in December, and the intermittent rain was starting to turn into snow. Since the ladies were decked out and we were feeling important on this special occasion, we decided to take a cab up to the show. Well, cabs, as there were six of us and we wouldn't all fit in one. So we shuffled out to the curb and hailed down two taxis, back to back. I got in the first one with three of the girls, and Eric and the other girl, Susan, I believe, got in the second one, and we agreed to gather in front of the club and all go in together. I was buzzing with excitement, and a little herb, taking a luxurious cab ride, anticipating the show. I was dying to see how Yellow was going to pull off their songs, as they are all decidedly studio-created affairs. The cab ride wasn't that long, and we soon found ourselves standing in front of the club. It was the Roxy, on the east side of town, in a not particularly good neighborhood. But we weren't there to cruise the neighborhood. We were there to go see Yellow, so we stood up against the wall and waited for Eric and Susan to show up. They couldn't be far behind us because we left at virtually the same moment, and Eric knew enough about Manhattan to know if he was being driven astray, so we huddled together against the wall and waited. And waited. And waited. 5 minutes passed. 10 minutes passed. 15. What the fuck? Cabs came and went, but no Eric. Then, I suddenly noticed there was a group of guys cruising the girls. These guys were big and scary looking, and didn't know or care that these women were crazy and not suitably stable enough for a long-term relationship. They didn't seem particularly interested in a long-term relationship. All they saw were three beautiful 18-year-old dancers in dresses. And me. Apparently, they thought the only thing standing between them and these fine young ladies was me. Which is also what the girls thought as they pulled in a little closer. While a couple of guys stood back and slowly looked the girls up and down, grunting and smacking their lips, one of them came right up and stood in my face. He didn't say a word, but he stared at me in a way that made my blood run cold. My blood was already pretty cold because we'd been standing in the sleet for 20 minutes. Still no Eric and Susan. I quickly played out a couple of scenarios in my head, and none of them looked particularly good. Figuring Eric and Susan had ditched us and gone off to some hotel for a quick tryst, and realizing that there would be just more of this evil dance between me and the girls and the guys in the club, I reluctantly hailed a cab, got everybody in, and took them back to their apartment. I apologized and got on the train and went back to my apartment. Of all the shows I have missed in my life, that was the most bitter. Because, as far as I know, that was just about the only show that Yellow played. Ever. Years later, I ran across Live at the Roxy, a limited edition record of part of that show. It was a one-sided record, and consisted of an amazing 15-minute long track, full of sound and fury and beats and effects, one of the most amazing live documents I've ever heard. And I was right there, leaning up against the wall of the club. I couldn't have been closer, but I missed it. However, Eric didn't. He and Susan took a different route to the club and were let off a block away. They hopped out of the cab, braced themselves against the sleet, and started walking the wrong way. They walked for blocks and blocks before finally giving up and turning around and heading the other direction. All told, they were walking in the slushy sleet for half an hour before they finally made it to the door of the Roxy, 3 minutes after we had given up on them and left. Figuring, reasonably enough, that we had gone inside, they went in to find us, and spent the whole night wandering through the dim, cavernous, crowded club, fruitlessly looking for us. At one point, Eric had a similar experience to me and found himself dancing with Susan while a circle of slathering wolves closed in on them. Eric realized, as I had, that he was supposed to be her protector, and things didn't look too good. Just then, the show started, and, relieved, they turned their attention to the stage. Yellow came out and played an amazing 15-minute opener, the same bit that got released on the EP. They started another song, but had some trouble with the equipment, futzed with it a bit, and then called it a night. Oh. Eric couldn't believe it. All that hassle, all that walking in the slush and snow, all that wandering around the club, all those scary moments realizing he was in way over his head and could very quickly be in a lot of trouble, all that for a 15-minute show. Disgusted, he grabbed Susan's hand and stormed out of the club, depositing her back at her apartment before making his way back to our place. He was pissed at me. I was pissed at him. But we talked it through, laughed about the absurdity of it, and soon put it behind us. Although, funny thing, those girls never called us to go out again. 2 years later, I was in my second year at Hampshire College and had taken a bus into neighboring Northampton to kill a Saturday afternoon and go to the area's best record store, Main Street Records. I walked in and glanced over the new arrivals rack and was delighted to see a new album from Yellow called Stella. I snatched it up, cut my afternoon short, and caught the next bus back to campus so I could hear it. If I had to pick an overall favorite Yellow album, Stella would be it. The improvement in sound was absolutely astonishing, and I didn't think it could get any better than on You Gotta Say Yes to Another Excess.
The sun blowing the moon away lights me up for one more day.
The production was gigantic and crystalline, with songs sounding like they were carved right out of the wind. They were now a duo, having dropped Carlos Perón, but even Dieter Meier was in rare form, his vocals actually enhancing most of the tracks they appear on. The album opens with two surprisingly straight songs, Desire and Vicious Games. They both have very standard structures and even some pretty basic electric guitar noodling, but the production sets them apart from anything else being done at the time, with the possible exception of Trevor Horn. Somehow, both Boris Blank and Trevor Horn managed to squeeze sounds out of their studios that were years ahead of their contemporaries. The music has an impossible depth. It is incredibly airy, full of echo, yet extremely precise at the same time, each sound standing in perfect isolation and yet contributing seamlessly to the whole. It is absolutely breathtaking. And those are the least interesting tracks on the album. Then comes Oh Yeah, and the album takes off into uncharted territory.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh Yeah became Yellow's biggest hit, thanks partly to its inclusion in Ferris Bueller's Day Off and The Secret of My Success. Oh Yeah sounds like nothing else, and it is impossibly catchy. The combination of Meier's deep, treated vocals, the wild, almost cartoony percussive elements, the polished and engaging production, the inventive arrangement, and the repeating make the song absolutely irresistible, unfortunately. Despite its appeal, it didn't really catch on until well after Stella had been released, so it was also released on the next album, 1 Second, as well, and appears as a B-side on numerous singles. As much as I love Yellow, and this song in particular, I did get a bit tired of it there. The rest of Stella is superb, with tight, scratchy rhythm guitars juxtaposed next to the biggest, echoing through the Grand Canyon bass and propulsive beats and imaginative sounds blended together in fantastic arrangements. There's the melodramatic horror film soundtrack Stalag Drama, the scorching guitar-driven ode to internal holiness Domingo, and the frenetic percussion orgy featuring a chicken, Let Me Cry. The album ends with a phenomenal 1-2 punch. Ciel Ouvert, the longest cut on the album, is a cinematic instrumental that sounds like a heroic journey through treacherous lands and has the biggest sounds possible, large enough to topple a mountain. For years, this was the track I used to test a stereo or set of speakers, as it has both some of the most delicate sounds imaginable, as well as some of the deepest and most stirring. Listening to it, even after hundreds, if not thousands of times, still gives me goosebumps. This leads directly into the last cut, the blazing Angel No, a dance till you drop track with punchy horns, nuclear bass notes, and body slamming beats. Years later, Yellow released 1 Second, which continued to refine their sound. Nearly as good as Stella, 1 Second closes the door on their more experimental work, and they settle into being imaginative Eurodance innovators, nearly all of their tracks crafted for the dance floor. On 1 Second, they open their ranks slightly, inviting big-voiced Shirley Bassey, known mostly in this country for singing theme songs to James Bond movies, but a bigger star in her native England, and 4-octave Scottish singer Billy McKenzie to sing a couple of songs. Love comes from this album, and is one of my favorite of all Yellow songs, with its odd, disjointed beginning and trademark blizzard of beats. There must be 30 different percussion sounds in a typical Yellow tune, yet they all fit together so smoothly that you don't really notice the astonishing variety unless you really listen to it. I love the way this song is constructed, and I especially favor the sexy hummed refrain. Boris Blank has a remarkable gift for fitting wildly disparate elements together and making them sound all of a piece. He is especially good at varying the ambience of each particular sound, so that some of them are absolutely bone dry with no presence whatsoever, usually the rhythm guitars, and others sounding like they were recorded in the world's deepest well. What would have quickly become a mess in lesser producers' hands, muddy beyond comprehension, he somehow manages to keep clear. These sounds should not work together, and nobody else would ever even think of trying to put them together, but under Blank's masterful touch, they sound positively inevitable. At the end of my first semester of my last year at Hampshire, I was in love with G. Although she wasn't G then, she was just Chris, and I wouldn't have admitted my feelings for her at the time, even to myself. We had been spending a lot of time together, a lot of time, and she kept asking if there was more than friendship brewing between us, but I couldn't bring myself to admit it, terrified of what would happen if we tried to make it physical, and yet longing to do just that. My physical failures at every critical moment in my past had made me hopelessly shy and nervous when romance or sex came up. She didn't believe that there wasn't more brewing between us, but I was adamant, so to subconsciously bring things to a head. The weekend before Christmas break, she went out on a date with some jerk. I was devastated, but what could I say? If I wasn't willing to step up to the plate and try to hit the ball, then I had to sit on the bench and watch somebody else make their way around the bases. Chris and her best friend Kristen agreed to drive me to the airport so I could catch a flight down to Tallahassee and spend Christmas with my folks. I threw my bag in the trunk and slumped moodily into the back seat of the car, trying to figure my emotions out. Chris and Kristen chatted away, and all I could do was hum the throaty, sexy hums from Call It Love, which was in heavy rotation on my stereo at the time. We got to the airport, and I got out of the car and pulled my bag from the trunk. I hugged Kristen goodbye and wished her a Merry Christmas. Chris and I embraced, and she gave me a small paper bag, wishing me Merry Christmas, kissing me on the cheek, and waving me off. I got onto the plane and took a seat by the window. The day was gray, the sky thick with faceless clouds, and little eddies of snow were skittering across the tarmac. The plane taxied down the runway and roared into the sky. I picked up the paper bag and opened it. Inside was a brown teddy bear, with a hard red heart sewn into its soft, warm chest. I looked down at it, tears filling my eyes. This nameless feeling, this uncertain emotion that had been torturing me for weeks, came into sharp focus as I looked down at that beautiful, tragic bear. The plane burst through the clouds and the sunlight poured into the window, and I turned to watch the gray disappear into exuberant billows of white, my eyes stinging, my chest collapsing. I could finally admit what was in my heart, my hard plastic heart. I knew what to call that painfully breathless, stomach-churning feeling now. I could call it love.